This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We want answers right now. But this planet does not work on a human timetable. While you and I stress about politics, the pandemic, and maybe food for the week, Earth works on deep movements that we can miss in the moment until they arrive as a shocking disaster. This program is devoted to two such slow powers. We travel to the ends of the Earth, Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica. Nothing can stop ice larger than England sliding into the sea. It will flood coastal cities around the world. While the sea is rising, land is sinking under 1 in 5 people alive. If you want the big picture underneath the future, don't miss geoglaciologist Sridhar Anandakrishnan from Penn State and Dr. Devin Galloway from the U.S. Geological Survey. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's go.
It's an urgent scientific mission at the far edge of what's possible, to the edge of a massive melting glacier.
Only a few hundred humans have been to a place that may determine the future survival of many great cities. That is not science fiction on another planet. Scientists now have millions of dollars to find out if and when the massive Thwaites Glacier will flood coasts and port cities around the world. Our guest Sridhar Anandakrishnan has stood on the Antarctic ice many times. As professor of geosciences at Penn State University, Sridhar uses satellites, computers, and even explosions to discover what drives glaciers larger than countries into the sea. Dr. Sridhar Anandakrishnan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Why don't we start, if you could serve as our travel guide, how do you get to Thwaites Glacier and what will we find when we arrive?
Yeah, so the way one gets to Thwaites Glacier, which is in Antarctica, which is around, as most of you probably know, the South Pole, one has to travel first to the countries closest to the South Pole, and that would be either New Zealand or Chile. Those are the two jumping off points for most people. There's some people that travel by ship, for example. But if you're going to fly there, you need to get close enough so that your airplane can make the rest of the trip. So what I normally do is fly by commercial flights to New Zealand, to Christchurch, New Zealand. And from there, there is a U.S. government airplane that flies researchers to the main U.S. base in Antarctica called McMurdo Station. From McMurdo Station, you have to travel to the actual glacier that we're studying, in this case, Thwaites Glacier, and that's about 600 miles or so, 550, 600 miles from McMurdo, so that's another airplane flight, and there we use small ski-equipped airplanes that can land right on the glacier. So it's quite an involved trip, and as you can imagine, in such remote areas where you have to worry about weather conditions, there are a lot of delays involved, and so you have to learn to be patient.
You must have to plan this like a bit of a military campaign or a scientific expedition to get all the right equipment and people and everything lined up.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. And in fact, the military assists us quite a bit. A lot of these airplanes are actually flown by the U.S. military, the Air Force, or the U.S. Air National Guard, in a purely support capacity. And then our part of it is to be prepared, to have all our equipment boxed up safely and have all the right equipment. And more importantly yet, have all the right spares, because as you probably know, if you've ever been away from home, things break as soon as you go on a long trip and you need to be able to fix it. Well, in Antarctica, you can't call AAA or stop into the nearest hardware store to pick up any nuts or bolts that you might be missing. And so you have to have all your parts with you.
Why is it called the Thwaites Glacier and how big is it?
So Thwaites Glacier is on what's called the Amundsen Sea coast of Antarctica. All of these names in Antarctica, Amundsen, Thwaites, McMurdo, are named after people who have contributed to the understanding, to the exploration, to the research of Antarctica. And there are many other names that are sort of honor people from around the world. But Amundsen was a Norwegian explorer, the first man at the South Pole back in 1911. And then Thwaites was a glacial geologist from Wisconsin. He was a state geologist for Wisconsin in the 1940s, and he was sort of instrumental in helping to understand the glacial geology of North America. And so to honor his contribution to science, there's a committee that names features in Antarctica. So that's how Thwaites Glacier got its name.
And it's bigger than Great Britain, for example?
It is. So Thwaites Glacier is an enormous place. I live in Pennsylvania. I teach at Penn State University. And Thwaites Glacier is about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. It's slightly larger than Great Britain. And so that gives you a sense of the scale of this one glacier.
Sridhar, why are scientists worried about this relatively unknown glacier in Antarctica?
The reason people are so focused in the last few years on Thwaites Glacier is because, one, it's an enormous glacier that is changing very, very rapidly. Satellite imagery, satellite measurements over all of Antarctica has shown that this sector of the continent is shrinking at one of the most rapid paces of anywhere around the continent. As your listeners will no doubt know, there's a very tight connection between glacier size and sea level. All the water that melts and is lost from glaciers has only one place to go, and that's the ocean. So when these glaciers, and in particular this glacier, shrinks and loses mass, loses ice, all of the mass, all the ice that it loses ends up melts and goes into the ocean and raises sea level around the whole planet. Thwaites Glacier, as I said, is an enormous glacier, size of Pennsylvania, size of Great Britain. And a lot of concern has been raised in the last decade that it is melting enormously fast and has the potential to raise sea level over the next 50 to 100 years in ways that would be devastating for coastlines around the world.
Well, there's something really important in what you just said, because I think when I started this show about 15 years ago, scientists said that significant sea level rise from Antarctica might come in hundreds or even thousands of years in the future. But now it seems much more imminent that people living now will see sea level rise from Thwaites Glacier.
Concern about Antarctica has always been somewhat muted for, as you say, for the last few decades. But in the last 5 to 10 years, the measurements of Thwaites Glacier and some of the numerical models of Thwaites Glacier show that it has been shrinking far more rapidly than anticipated. Now, there are people going back 30 and 40 years who warned about this or hypothesized, theorized about how this glacier might pose a danger, but the evidence wasn't there. The measurements weren't there, and scientists are conservative creatures for the most part. We have no crystal ball to look into the future, and so it's only in the last, as I said, 5 to 10 years that the measurements and the models have caught up with reality, and we recognize that Thwaites Glacier is actually quite a dire danger, possible danger. And the science isn't even now settled. I know your listeners, as savvy consumers of science news, will know. As scientists, we try to give you the best possible picture that we have. And so that sometimes sounds like we're fudging our language, but it's simply because we don't know fully what's going to happen.
I watched a YouTube video of your presentation to the International Glaciological Society on April 22, 2020, just last year, and you explained the Thwaites Glacier has marine ice sheet instability. Please take a couple minutes to explain what that means.
Thwaites Glacier is subject to what's called a marine ice sheet instability. So this glacier, if I can try and paint a mental picture of it, or a picture that your listeners can try and envision, and perhaps you can point them at this YouTube video as well, Thwaites Glacier is what's called an over-deepened glacier. In other words, the bottom of the glacier, the bed of the glacier, the base of the glacier actually gets deeper and deeper and deeper as you get further from the coastline. So this is a glacier that flows from the interior of Antarctica out to the coast, out to the ocean, and it's actually quite thin where it goes afloat at the ocean. If you were to walk inland from there, it gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and its bottom gets deeper and deeper and deeper. All right, so that's the mental picture you should have of this glacier. The reason why that's important is that as the glacier shrinks, the front of it, the face of it, the part of it that floats in the ocean is actually getting thicker and deeper over time. So as that face retreats back into the interior, it's not climbing up a mountain the way you might imagine a glacier in British Columbia or in the mountains of Alaska. Those glaciers, as they shrink back, they have to climb up the mountain. This glacier, as it shrinks back, it's actually going down deeper and deeper into this over-deepening in the interior. And that's fundamentally unstable. When I say unstable, that means that the process of retreating back from the coastline actually makes it retreat faster, which means that it goes into the deeper part, which makes it retreat faster, which makes it go into the deeper part, which makes it retreat faster. So this could be an explosively fast retreat, and that's why we worry about Thwaites Glacier over the next 100 years.
And as it gets thicker, then the oceanside cliffs of ice get higher, and those are more likely to fall apart.
So as the glacier retreats into this over-deepening, the face that faces on the ocean, as you point out, is now towering much higher above you, above the ocean. And as you well know, things that tower higher and higher become more susceptible to breakage. So this is what we call the marine ice cliff instability. And it's the same kind of sort of explosive retreat could take place where you create a cliff, the cliff breaks. Well, now you have a higher cliff because what's behind the current cliff is actually taller. And then that's more likely to break, and now you have a yet higher cliff, and that is more likely to break. Boom, 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 boom. It just keeps going back.
So as part of your research, you set explosives deep in the ice. What are you trying to find out?
So one of the most basic pieces of information that we need about a glacier in order to be able to create good projections into the future, make accurate computer models to be able to say, well, what's this glacier going to look like in 100 years or 500 years? We need a couple of things. We need to know how thick the glacier is. And as you can imagine, that's not a trivial exercise. Here you are standing on the surface of the glacier, and the question you're asking is, how far below my feet is the rock? One of the ways we can do that is by setting off an explosive charge at the surface, and the amount of time it takes for the echo of that charge to travel through the ice, hit the bottom of the glacier, and then come back up to us tells us how thick the glacier is, because we know how fast that sound travels, so we can measure how thick the glacier is. The second piece of information that we get from that echo is what the properties of the rock below the glacier is. This glacier, and many, many glaciers around the world, slide over there, over the bedrock that's below them. And so the character of that bed is critically important to the way that they slide. If it's a very soft surface, then the glacier slides in one way. If it's a very hard or rough surface, it slides in a different way. And so this echo from the explosive charge at the surface gives us information about the properties of that rock, and that goes into the models as well.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Penn State geoscientist and Professor Sridhar Anandakrishnan. We are investigating the single biggest threat to sea level rise worldwide, the glaciers in Antarctica called the Thwaites Glacier, and it could arrive with flooding cities from London to New York to Shanghai in the future. So most of the media stories about ice and sea level rise concern spectacular changes in Greenland ice. Sridhar, how does the sea level threat from Antarctica compare?
As you know, Greenland is very much in the forefront of our concerns. And one of the reasons for that is that the temperatures in Greenland are rising incredibly fast. If you've been following the news, you know that the sea ice of the Arctic Sea is thinning and shrinking and has not been forming as reliably every year. Ships can now navigate through the Northwest Passage north of Canada, which they couldn't do 50 years ago. So there's a lot of concern about Greenland because things are warming very, very rapidly up there. And so Greenland is responding to that and losing mass and it consequently raising sea level. Antarctica has not been warming as rapidly, though it is warming in places. Certainly the Antarctic Peninsula is warming. So the concern has always been a little bit more muted because Antarctica is a much colder place and it isn't warming as rapidly. Well, as it turns out, the oceans that circle around Antarctica are warming. They're connected to the global ocean system. And because of that warming of the oceans and the changing of the winds in Antarctica, it's a lot more subtle than Greenland. But because Antarctica is so much larger of a continent with so much more ice than Greenland, even small changes in Antarctica can have huge changes on global sea level.
And another worry on Greenland, abnormally high temperatures cause surface melt, which gets to the bottom and speeds big ice sliding towards the sea. Is that happening in Antarctica too?
The surface of the ice in Antarctica is considerably colder than the surface of the ice along the margins of Greenland. And so we haven't seen those sort of massive melting and melt ponds and fracture through the ice in the main part of Antarctica. There's a piece of Antarctica that sticks north towards South America. It's called the Antarctic Peninsula. And we have seen this surface melting and surface ponding of water and fracture of the ice due to this ponded water in that part of it. But in the main Antarctic ice sheet, there have been episodic melt days where it's gotten warm enough. But for the most part, it's remained quite cold on the surface. Now, there are some worrisome studies projecting out 20 to 30 years that say that Antarctica could warm a lot faster than it has been in the last 20 to 30 years. That's something that has not been built into a lot of the models because people are still actively working on seeing what the surface temperatures will look like in the next decades.
Around 2014, Eric Rigneaux of NASA said the retreat of the Thwaites Glacier is now unstoppable. Do you agree, and what does that mean for us?
Yeah, so it was quite a landmark study by Eric Rigneaux and his colleagues, and there have been studies by others, Ian Jockin, for example, at the University of Washington that also show that Thwaites Glacier is a great danger. And I do agree that if we continue on the current path of CO2 emissions and temperature rise, that Thwaites Glacier is absolutely unstoppable. The more important question is the rate at which Thwaites Glacier will lose mass and the rate at which it will contribute water to the ocean. And that's very much open to study, and there's no definitive answer to that. And a lot of that lies with the character of the rock beneath the glacier. Depending on what you think that rock is made up of, whether it's a hard sort of crystalline rock or whether it's more soft and sedimentary and wet, you get a very different answer on the rate at which the glacier will retreat. I think Eric's conclusion is correct. Yes, Thwaites Glacier is going away. The more important question is how fast is it going away?
What is the International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration and where can we find out more about it?
The International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration is a project that has been established by the U.S. National Science Foundation and the British NERC, National Environmental Research Council, I think it is. It's the British equivalent of the U.S. National Science Foundation. So between a partnership between the governments of the U.K. and the U.S., they've funded a set of seven sort of linked and connected projects to study Thwaites Glacier from aspects that we think are very important. We need information to be able to project what Thwaites Glacier looks like in the next 100 years. And there's critical pieces of information that are missing. We need better models. Those models need to be fed with better information about the characteristics of the glacier. We need to know something about the history of the glacier. We need to know something about the oceans around it. So these projects, which we've put under this umbrella of the International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration, are all aimed at different pieces of studying Thwaites Glacier. And the reason that the U.S. and the U.K. decided to make this an umbrella project like this is because, as I said at the beginning of the show, Thwaites is a difficult place to get to. And so in order for a single project to get there takes an enormous amount of logistical effort, and it makes sense to bring in a number of people at the same time so that they can share those resources. You can have a pulse of activity, bring people in, do this work, and hopefully get some answers. And people can learn more about it by going to thwaitesglacier.org. Thwaites is spelled T-H-W-A-I-T-E-S, so thwaitesglacier.org.
You and Andy Smith of the British Antarctic Survey were set to do more seismic testing in Antarctica. Has COVID slowed that down?
Dr. Smith from the British Antarctic Survey and I lead one part of this Thwaites Glacier collaboration. And ours was to do geophysical studies on Thwaites Glacier to study its thickness and the rock beneath it. And we were due to go in the field this year and next year. It's a two-year project, two-year field project. And all of that has been pushed off by a year. As a matter of fact, almost all science projects have been canceled for this year. We're currently in the Antarctic field season, as you know, in the Southern Hemisphere. November, December, January are the times that one can do work out in the field. And so we hope to have been out there now, and that's been canceled. We still have hopes for next year, and we'll just have to see how that goes. But my fear is that the follow-on, the knock-on effects from COVID will actually stretch out for longer in Antarctica than they do here in the U.S. or Canada.
What do you mean by that?
So if all goes well, we might have a semblance of normal life in North America by, let's say, this summer or late summer or something like that, where people can return to traveling and going to the store and so on and so forth. But Antarctica, everything happens on a different pace. So, for example, you have to bring in supplies a year ahead of time. So the ship goes in now and brings in all the supplies that will be used over the next year, and obviously they have a they keep an extra cache of stuff so that people can work for 2 or 3 years if the ship doesn't make it. But nevertheless, all of the supplies, fuel, food are brought in this year for work next year. Well, the ship didn't go in this year, and no work went on this year because of COVID. They didn't want to bring people to Antarctica who might get sick in such a remote place. But the ship didn't go either. And so next year, they might not have sufficient supplies, and they might be more focused on building those supplies back up again. And then it will only be in the following year that sort of normal field work can recommence. Now, on top of that, there will be pressure from all of these science groups who've now been delayed for 2 or 3 years, and so NSF will have to prioritize, okay, who gets the first bite of the apple, and so it's all up in the air at this point.
Well, we talked about it being possibly unstable, and this could mean that Shanghai and Sydney and San Francisco and London could all flood in the coming decades. So we do have a suggestion for geoengineering to stop this glacier from Michael Walovic and John Moore. What do you think about their proposals?
Yeah, so Michael and John have put together a very eye-catching idea that one could build a low seawall, if you will, beneath the glacier. So as I said, this glacier is over-deepened, but if you could keep it grounded near the ocean, then it wouldn't start to step back into that over-deepening. Unfortunately, I have two difficulties with that proposal or idea. It's not really a proposal. The first is that the dangers of CO2 and of warming are not solely related to Thwaites Glacier. Yes, the loss of ice from Thwaites Glacier and the consequent sea level rise is a terrible tragedy, but that's not the only danger of CO2 and temperature rise. There are droughts, changes in weather pattern, ocean acidification, all of these things that are affecting people around the world that we need to address this in a systemic way. We need to reduce our emissions of CO2, try and get temperature under control, because doing that would alleviate problems around the world as well as keeping Thwaites Glacier stable. The second issue, of course, is just a purely practical one. It is an enormously complex area to work in, and it is so far away from everything that, in my opinion, it's just impractical to attempt such an engineering project. It's just outside the scale possibilities, and it would cost a vast amount that would be much better spent on a transition to sustainable fuel sources.
On a personal note, we have some student listeners on college stations. They may not be sure of their direction. Were you the kind of kid who always wanted to study the ice world?
Interestingly enough, I grew up in India. I was born in India. I grew up there, went through school there. And I really came to understand glaciers relatively late in my life gain an appreciation or entree to them. I was in my 20s before I really knew very much about this, about glaciers and Antarctica and Greenland and all of this. And I just got fascinated by them at that point. So I loved exploration as a kid, but I was focused more on the moon. I wanted to be an astronaut. But going to Antarctica was perhaps my way of realizing my dream of going to the moon.
Well, it is a bit like another planet, and we don't yet have good maps of it, probably poorer maps than we have of Mars. But we have been speaking with Penn State geoscientist and Professor Sridhar Anandakrishnan, and you can check out ThwaitesGlacier.org or find links to his work in my show blog published at ecoshock.org. Sridhar, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Humans may cause the seas to rise, but it turns out we also collapse the ground beneath us. That is called subsidence. A new study finds almost 20% of the world's population will be affected by it. At least one world capital already plans to move away from the holes below. Sea level rise will be much worse where coastlines and ports are sinking at the same time. This strange threat of subsidence is seldom discussed in the media. One of the co-authors of a new global analysis about sinking land is Dr. Devin Galloway. He is a longtime scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. The paper is Mapping the Global Threat of Land Subsidence, published January 1, 2021. From Indiana, Devin Galloway, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Glad to be here.
What is subsidence? And can you start us out with a couple of examples?
There are many forms of land subsidence. It's generally speaking, a lowering of the land surface. It's that simple. the causes are both natural and human-induced or anthropogenic. Some of the natural causes are lowering of the land associated with tectonics, you know, earthquakes, volcanism, also the dissolution of carbonate and evaporite rock that typically make up the karst landform. And some of the anthropogenic causes involve withdrawing groundwater from the subsurface, which causes the aquifer systems that contain the groundwater to compact. Other anthropogenic causes are the draining of organic soils like peatlands, like is prominent in the Sacramento, San Joaquin Delta Islands in California, and also like the Netherlands. And that draining of those kinds of soils dries them out and causes the organic soils to oxidize and then compact. Those are the main causes of subsidence.
And how does this appear? How do people realize it is happening?
Yeah, that's the trick. It often happens so slowly that, you know, it's not a catastrophic event. It's a gradual process that occurs and accumulates over time. And the amount, say, on an annual basis can be so small that over short periods of time, it's virtually not recognizable unless you measure it. The standard way of measuring it is using land surveys or more recently remote sensing using interferometric synthetic aperture radar or INSAR, which is basically a way to detect the motion of land surface using satellite radar processing.
You know, before reading your paper, I thought about the slow movement of Earth's surface. I mean, New England is sinking because it was puffed up for a while by the weight of glaciers 10,000 years ago, and it takes quite a while for the land to settle back down again. So there is, I guess, a difference between geological sinking and the human-driven subsidence.
Yeah. In the case that you mentioned, you're right. That, let's call it relaxation of the Earth's surface due to the unloading of the melting glaciers or the long-ago disappeared ice sheets, it does occur. And we are getting some basically subsidence due to flexure of the Earth's crust because we're unloading in the northern latitudes and the land is uplifting slightly there. But because of flexure, the land, let's say in New England and even the Chesapeake Bay along the east coast, is subsiding slightly. But the magnitudes of that subsidence, say, in the Chesapeake Bay and in New England, are small compared to the kind of subsidence that we're considering here in this science paper.
Why is the biggest city in Indonesia sinking, and what do they plan to do about it?
That's a good question. The consensus of thought right now is that sinking is primarily due to groundwater depletion in the Jakarta area. There are also other cities in Indonesia that are experiencing the same problem. But in Jakarta, I think more than 10 feet of subsidence has been measured very near the coast, pretty much at the coast. And that's been attributed to groundwater pumping and lowering of groundwater levels, and then a compaction of the aquifer systems from which the groundwater is withdrawn.
Devin Galloway, talk to us about the situation in Mexico City.
Oh, Mexico City. Well, that's a fairly well-studied process in Mexico City. They've experienced more than 30 feet of land subsidence over the past 75 years or so. It's caused, you know, widespread damages in Mexico City. It's presented some very drastic challenges to them in terms of repairing urban infrastructure, designing drainage ways, you know, conveying wastewater from the basin. Mexico City is in a closed basin, so they have to basically find a way to get the wastewater out of the basin. And again, that process has been attributed to the extensive groundwater use in the Mexico City area.
But your study finds the biggest impacts affecting hundreds of millions of people in the next few decades will be in Asia. Why is that?
Well, part of it is the growing population in Asia. More recently, the economic boom in Asia, which has augmented the population increases and the demand for water resources. And much of that demand is being met by groundwater resources. And in the particular areas where subsidence is being intensively recognized and studied now is, let's say, like in the North China Plain, where they rely heavily upon groundwater. And as these forces combine to increase the demand for groundwater, you know, the situation tends to get worse.
Are there relationships, Devin, between climate change and subsidence?
In terms of the type of subsidence that we focus on in this science paper, which is the subsidence related to the depletion of groundwater resources, global climate change is bringing about changes in how water is delivered to the Earth's surface in terms of snowfall or precipitation. It also changes both the temporal and spatial patterns of droughts. We expect global climate change to have an impact, you know, on this type of subsidence related to groundwater depletion, because in some areas it's going to make less water available to recharge these groundwater systems naturally.
I think your paper says drying out the ground actually makes places more vulnerable to flooding. That's counterintuitive to me. Could you explain that?
Well, I think by drying out the ground, it means we're depleting the groundwater resource. These are deep, usually deep aquifer systems that are being exploited, and they're compacting. So they're lowering the land surface as they compact. And that lowered land surface creates new flooding potential in terms of, you know, depressed areas in the ground surface where drainage is focused.
So you could buy a new home and look at a flood map that was made 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and not be aware that you're actually more vulnerable to flooding than it says.
Yes.
Right. So the new report also says, quote, substance permanently reduces aquifer system storage capacity. That sounds pretty serious to me. How does that work?
So in the type of subsidence that we're talking about here related to groundwater depletion, when the aquifer system compacts as groundwater levels lower, that compaction can be permanent and it's not recoverable. So what that results in is kind of a reduced pore space for the water, the groundwater, to occupy in those aquifer systems. But also some of the storage is related to the compressibility of the material of the skeleton. So as these systems compact, their compressibility reduces, as well as the pore space that the groundwater can occupy within these porous aquifer systems reduces. Essentially, we have the net effect of a reduced groundwater storage capacity because the groundwater is stored in these pores, and part of the storage is related to the compressibility of the system.
This sounds to me almost like a bit of a feedback in a system that will make things harder for people to live, because you've got lower ground, it can flood, but the ground can't hold those floodwaters, so they have to run around somewhere. And then you're going to run out of water, but you can't store as much under there, so you get sort of the worst of both. You get the floods and then you get droughts.
Yeah, and the loss of groundwater storage capacity is kind of a negative feedback process. Like it ratchets down. You can reduce the storage capacity, but you can't really increase it by recovering groundwater levels.
Now, like many branches of science, the data for parts of Africa are sparse or not there at all. I looked up subsidence in South Africa and found most of the talk was about sinkholes. Homes, parts of towns, chunks of prime agriculture just collapse into the ground, usually unexpectedly. Is that subsidence and is that widespread?
Yes, and sort of yes, but that's not the kind of subsidence that we're addressing in this paper. It is an important component, and it is often a catastrophic event. when the sinkholes suddenly appear. You know, this is of prime importance in certain areas where the geologic materials in those areas are susceptible to dissolution or being dissolved in the waters that are infiltrating these rocks.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Devin Galloway from the U.S. Geological Survey. We are talking about new science on subsidence, where land sinks, taking homes, business, roads, and fields down, gradually but certainly. Jakarta and Mexico City are among many that are sinking because humans pumped out so much groundwater. Devin, what about fracking and natural gas extraction? Can that lead to subsidence?
Good question. Natural gas extraction can. There's certainly well-documented cases of subsidence in gas fields and in oil reservoirs. But they tend to be fairly localized. So compared to the subsidence that we see with, let's say, groundwater resource utilization, which is really more widespread, it tends to be a relatively localized phenomenon. But yeah, that it is a serious concern in those local areas.
Should we only be talking about cities, or are agricultural areas also threatened by subsidence?
Yes, we should be concerned about agricultural areas. In fact, one prime example is in California, the Central Valley of California, which is a huge agricultural region in a semi-arid environment. A lot of groundwater has been used to basically supply the water demand for agricultural production in that valley. And I think in 1977, as much as 30 feet of subsidence, almost 30 feet by 1977, was measured in one location in that valley.
Yeah, I recall talking with Jay Famiglietti of NASA, and he told us that they could measure from the GRACE satellites that California is losing groundwater at a really rapid rate.
Yeah, I've seen those studies, and that's true, especially if you look back over, let's say, the past 50 to 75 years.
And then, Devin, we have this special case where sinking land happens to be at the coast. Will it be difficult to sort out how much flooding is caused by sea level rise versus the land sinking?
Yeah, I think it will be a little bit difficult. Right now, we rely a lot on tide gauges to sort of unravel the relative contributions of absolute sea level rise. And that's the sea level rise attributed basically to water coming into the ocean, say, from melting glaciers, versus the lowering of the land, which also contributes to sea level rise if you're at that point where the land is lowered. So, you know, the tide gauges that measure the sea level are tied into reference datums that are generally continental in scale. The problem is updating those reference datums so to make sure that the reference points that help define the precise location of those tide gauges in terms of the vertical positioning of them accounts for any lowering of the land surface occurring, you know, between the times that the reference points are checked. So I guess what I'm saying is we can estimate these absolute sea level changes, but we do have a relative sea level change that needs to take into account the land surface elevation at the coast.
It's a strange situation. I mean, a phrase in your paper really caught my eye. It said, in some cases, land subsidence may exceed the contribution from absolute sea level rise by a factor of 10 or more. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's an extreme case. But yeah, that's one of the motivating factors for writing this paper that we've written is this notion is often really overlooked and underaccounted for, especially globally. You know, recently in another paper that I was involved in, we looked at decades worth of record at a tide gauge off the coast of Galveston, Texas. And we attempted to determine the absolute sea level rise and the relative sea level rise. So we attempt to do account for the land subsidence there that contributed to the relative sea level rise. And there, I think it was a factor of about three times the absolute sea level rise.
That's quite a bit. And then on top of that, experts expect to see another billion people added to this planet in the next decade or so. A lot of them are hoping to get dishwashers and washing machines and flush toilets, and everybody needs a lot of water. Has your group considered what the impact of even higher demand will be on the pace of subsidence?
Yeah, that's addressed in the paper. We did consider, we predicted basically potential global subsidence in 2040 after having determined what that was for the year 2010. And yeah, we see increases in both, you know, groundwater demand that contributes to this type of land subsidence that we're addressing. I think in the paper in 2010, we estimated that about 19% of the global population was impacted by land subsidence, this type of land subsidence. And by 2040, I think that could grow to as much as about 25% of the global population.
And that's going to cost a lot of money, a lot of, you know, industry, and there will be losses.
Exactly. I guess one of the most understudied aspects of this process is, what are the costs? A few countries publish annual costs of land subsidence. You know, China is one example, and the Netherlands is another. But virtually no place else does that. And in trying to make people aware of this global phenomenon, it's difficult because, you know, we want to do kind of a risk-benefit analysis, but we have a hard time getting a handle on both the direct and indirect costs of this type of subsidence.
We have the International Panel on Climate Change. Is there any international body tasked with tracking the subsidence problem?
Not that I'm aware of. And, you know, this paper, the most of the co-authors on this paper are members or associate members of a UNESCO Land Subsidence International Initiative. And that initiative, which consists of a committee of members and associate members, that is their mission, basically, is to do this. But it's kind of an ad hoc, if you will, community of concerned scientists that are doing this.
Once we know a city or region is prone to land sinking, is there anything that can be done about it?
Yes. The mitigation measures, I guess, fundamentally are fairly straightforward. And basically it is to maintain groundwater levels above critical thresholds. That essentially slows way down, or can actually stop or slightly reverse a little bit some of the subsidence. But achieving that is very difficult because the need for the groundwater resources are so great, both domestically and culturally, economically, socially. It's very difficult to institute the measures to actually achieve those groundwater level thresholds.
It's a tough problem because I can't walk out in my backyard and say, this ground looks a little bit lower than it was yesterday. It's slow moving, but then eventually buildings start to get a slant to them or break apart even. It's something we have to watch out for. Do you think that this is subsidence and sustainable water use something we all need to add to the urgent list?
Yeah, I do. I definitely do. You know, right now in the world, there are many urgent things on that list, I'm sure. But I think this definitely needs to be a component of our consideration of groundwater sustainability globally.
Devin, before becoming a hydrogeologist for the U.S. Geological Survey, you studied biology and medicine. 40 years later, what do you think young people today should be studying and working to change?
Oh, boy. Well, in terms of geosciences or something else?
Well, let's go with geosciences. That's your specialty.
Some of these resources are finite, like for groundwater, for instance. It's a principal component of our water supply. I think we need to look at it not in terms of it as being an infinite resource. It's really a finite resource, especially when you consider impacts or consequences of its use like this, like compaction of the aquifer systems, loss of storage capacity, land subsidence. There are consequences to its use. And because of this loss of storage capacity, essentially you can consider part of its use as mining the water, as mining the system. It's a one-time use of the water up to a point. So this idea of sustainability comes into play, both in terms of the consequences of loss of future groundwater storage capacity, but also the consequences of land subsidence and the costs and the other hazards that are associated with that need to be considered.
We need to recycle our water as well as our paper and our glass.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been speaking with scientist Devin Lynn Galloway from the U.S. Geological Survey. He is co-author of the new paper, Mapping the Global Threat of Land Subsidence, as published in the journal Science, January 1st, 2021. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Devin, thank you for telling us about the underground.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
We just have time for a sample from my newest YouTube video. It is called Earth Energy, as I share my search for the Earth energy imbalance raised by NASA's Dr. James Hansen and other scientists. That is how climate change is really measured, it turns out.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Everybody wants to know, how hot will it get? It's global warming, right? But if you just watch temperature, you don't know climate change. Until we all understand the energy disease we made on this planet, we will not stop a catastrophe beyond experience or imagination, and it's rolling right towards us. Strange questions pop up, like why does melting ice slow warming, while snow adds heat? If only a tiny percent of our greenhouse gases actually warm the atmosphere, why are we getting year after year of record heat? Scientists are still finding out. Politicians and business owners don't know. The public has no clue, even as a dangerous shift is underway. Let's look at the most important number. Naturally, we humans want to know the temperature and other signs of global climate change right around us. But as James Hansen explains in his December post, Global Warming Acceleration, the real place determining our future is at the top of the atmosphere. I made a video about that, Global Warming Acceleration. You can check it out at ecoshock.org. But what we're looking at here is not really a place. It's a region, and it's about 100 kilometers or 62 miles above our heads. That is the top of the atmosphere. And that is where tremendous energy from the sun enters our planetary sphere. It's also where Earth leaks energy back into space. Here is what you need to grasp, contained in the very first paragraph of the paper by von Schuckmann's team. Quote, human-induced atmospheric composition changes cause a radiative imbalance at the top of the atmosphere, which is driving global warming. This Earth energy imbalance, EEI, is the most critical number defining the prospects for continued global warming and climate change. Have you heard about EEI in the media? From your friends? Not likely, but Earth Energy Imbalance, EEI, is key to understanding the climate shift. Parts per million of carbon dioxide is important, sure, but that is just part of what makes global warming. The paper, Heat Stored in the Earth System, continues, quote, understanding the heat gain of the Earth system, and particularly how much and where heat is distributed, is fundamental to understanding how this affects warming, the ocean, atmosphere, and land. Rising surface temperature, sea level, and loss of grounded and floating ice, which are fundamental concerns for society, end quote, from that paper. So burn into your brain, EEI means Earth Energy Imbalance. If we don't fix that imbalance, Earth will continue to warm, likely ending this civilization, transforming what lives and what dies. We can lie to ourselves about progress, science, just about everything. The physics on this planet does not care. Now scientists can measure changes in the Earth energy imbalance since the 1970s when satellite measurements began. That imbalance is growing bigger at a faster rate with each decade. You must know Earth has a system that is not defined by us. During the last few hundred thousand years when modern humans evolved, the climate went through long, slow cycles between very large glaciers and warmer times of expanding tropics. Aside from volcanic powers within the Earth's core and very rare strikes of asteroids, the climate was regulated by the position of the Earth relative to the Sun. During recorded history, there has been a 10,000-year balance of energy flows in from space and out again. We call that the Holocene. That's where we grew up. We broke that with fossil fuels and agriculture, forcing a new age called the Anthropocene, where humans drive the climate. The Sun has not changed significantly in that short period of time. The amount of solar energy reaching the Earth remains pretty much the same, despite going through minor cycles of sunspots or no sunspots. What changed? We added a blanket of gases that prevent some of the solar energy bouncing back out into space. We need to know, where does the energy go? If you are running a small business or a household, you need to track money coming in or out. There are all kinds of detailed expenses. You may save some money for later, or perhaps you are borrowing every month to get by. The planet we live on has an energy budget, and that is what we really need to understand. Scientists try to account for energy using something called the Global Climate Observing System, or GCOS. That was established by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So far, that is just a plan, a work plan for world scientists who contribute knowledge to how this Earth economy runs. James Hansen and many other scientists say the key is what happens at the top of the atmosphere. In the September 2020 paper, this team says, quote, "All energy entering or leaving the Earth climate system does so in the form of radiation at the top of the atmosphere, TOA. We have to leave this sample of my YouTube video, Earth Energy. Find it in my show blog at ecoshock.org. The awful force of climate change will not take a year or two off during the pandemic or anything else. You and I need to keep learning, talking to others, and supporting climate action even now. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week.